Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote, and this is Talking Australia. Today, I'm talking to fairy tern expert Claire Greenwell. Claire has dedicated her life to understanding and conserving Australia's fairy terns, an adorable group of beach nesting seabirds listed as vulnerable to extinction. In 2019, Claire documented the devastating attack by a single cat on a fairy tern colony in Mandurah, Western Australia, the very first tangible example of an individual feral predator's destructiveness. But Claire hasn't given up her fight, so I'm really excited to be talking to her on this episode of Talking Australia. Claire, your image of a very young fairy tern adorably trying to take flight has been shortlisted in the threatened species category of the Australian Geographic Nature Photographer of the Year competition. Now, this is kind of a reoccurring subject for you. What draws you to fairy terns?
I'm undertaking a PhD and I'm looking at various aspects of behaviour, the life history, so what fairy terns get up to during the breeding season, as well as their feeding ecology. So I'm using that information, I guess, in a broader scope of being able to try and inform conservation efforts for this threatened species.
And where did your journey in ornithology kind of begin? Did it start with fairy terns or did they kind of come in later?
They did come in later. So I have been interested in birds for a really long time. And I guess it was a childhood dream of mine to become a marine biologist. So I actually started studying as a mature age student to become a marine biologist. And at the end of my research, I went off and I did, at the end of my degree, I went off and did some research looking at feeding by octopus, which was really interesting. But I guess going into my PhD, I really wanted a project with strong conservation values. I was interested in birds, and so the prospect of doing a project on seabirds gave me that opportunity to combine my love of the ocean and then working with birds. So marine birds is the perfect outlet, I guess, for my research.
So it was kind of like bringing together two passions, marine life and bird life.
That's right, yep.
And I just want to go back to the photography element of your work as well, because did you develop photography skills throughout your degree, or was it something that you kind of just wanted to be able to do to promote fairy terns as an animal?
It's probably really just, I guess I picked up the camera and I bought a camera just before I started my PhD. So I'm pretty new to photography. I've only been going for a couple of years and I wanted to be able to document my research. So I wasn't experienced in any way and I started, you know, just learning a few things online and seeing how I could improve my skills. And over time, I have obviously developed those skills. And last season, I was documenting the diet of fairy terns. And so the birds actually bring the prey back to the colonies. The males provision their mates during the breeding period, early breeding period, so that the females can gain enough nutrients and energy to be able to lay eggs. But then obviously once the chicks start hatching, both the males and the females provision their young. And so by being on the edge of the colony, I was able to capture all the prey that was being brought back in. And so we call each photograph a digi voucher, and then using those digi vouchers I can go through and ID all the different fish species and then determine what they're actually eating. But that particular photo, it wasn't a planned thing. I had been out in the field and there was a bit of a lull period where there wasn't many fish coming in, And I saw the young tern starting to flap its wings. And so I got down low and just took a couple of shots, and I just managed to get that shot where it jumped. And so when I looked down at the camera and saw that it was sharp, it was really exciting to be able to see that. Because I'm trying to be able to capture all the different behaviours, as I have a project which I'm hoping to complete when I finish my PhD and write a book on the behaviour and the life history of fairy terns. So being able to capture all that information is really important.
And I guess a big part of your work is promoting the profile of the fairy tern. What do you tell people about fairy terns to get them excited?
Well, I guess if you look at a fairy tern, they're such a beautiful bird, particularly during the breeding season. They've got that iridescent white plumage with a dark black head cap, and then they've got the contrasting orange bill and legs. And so they've just got that beautiful appearance. And then, with the terns, they're so streamlined, and, they've got the long tails. So they are very beautiful to look at visually. But then, particularly in Western Australia, we do have quite a large population of fairy terns compared to the eastern states. And so if you go down to, there's a few locations where you can regularly see fairy terns in the summer, people are attracted to those sites, to look specifically for the birds. And also there's a couple of areas where the birds breed. And so I guess being able to get the photography to share a message, but then also being able to convey a message about what the birds are doing is really important, to be able to highlight the impacts of the birds. So this is a threatened species, and they nest on typically beaches, near shore environments. And I guess It's a rare opportunity for people to come and see nature and to see fairy terns in the Perth metropolitan area. So it's quite a spectacle.
And one of your studies from last year really, really took off internationally as well. Basically, it was about how a single cat had obliterated an entire colony of fairy terns in Mandurah in southwestern Australia. Take me through how that study sort of began.
Yeah, it was so devastating. While this is one example, it's certainly not an isolated incident. This is happening all the time. Introduced predators, foxes and cats, are a significant problem for fairy terns and other beach nesting birds. And so I guess my work, while it highlights the impact for a single animal to devastate a colony of birds, it's certainly not an isolated event, so that's really important. But so I'd started monitoring a colony down in Mandurah that had started in October. The site was established initially because there was a lack of natural breeding areas in Mandurah. So Mandurah is a historically important breeding and feeding site for fairy terns, and they're attracted to the area because of the large numbers of bait fish that occur there. But unfortunately, due to increasing tidal levels within the estuary, there's now no natural sites that can be used throughout the breeding season, because one storm event would lead to colony inundation. So the fairy terns had been nesting in the Mandurah Ocean Precinct and on a couple of vacant blocks there, but they were since developed. So the Mandurah City Council, they recognised the need to create a site for the fairy terns. And so the fairy terns in 2018, they began nesting there in around October, and the colony built up to around, well, at its peak, there were 111 nests. Now, the colony was progressing well. They had been there for several weeks and the chicks were just starting to hatch. So everything was progressing really well, and we thought it was going to be the most productive season in the Mandurah region for many decades. Unfortunately, I recognised that something was wrong. On one morning when I arrived, there was a lot of the birds seemed to be really unsettled, and a couple of the chicks had died overnight, which I thought was quite strange. And then we started getting the reports from the residents across the road in the apartments about a white cat. This white cat appears to have come back on several occasions during a couple of week period, and it began depredating the turns. So we had evidence from cameras as well as the residents across the road, and, you know, these people were waking up in the middle of the night hearing the commotion in the colony to this white cat, and, you know, going down and scaring off the cat to try and get these birds through. So it created, you know, this immense drama, and obviously it was very distressing for everybody involved.
And you obviously, you got photos of the cat as well, because I remember seeing the image of the white cat kind of like coming out of the colony, and that looked really menacing.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, that photo actually has a story. So there was a local photographer who had been down to the sanctuary, and they had seen the cat. So this was in the day. And he wrote a letter to the editor in the local paper and said for people to please keep their cats indoors. Now, the city of Mandurah, they did some newspaper advertisements as well as sending out a letter to all the residents asking people to keep their cat indoors. So we thought that the problem had been resolved when the cat didn't come back for a number of nights. And during this period, we were actually doing stalkouts. So one of the residents actually lent me a bus, and we stayed there over the weekend. And on the first night that we stayed there, the cat visited the colony on three occasions, and we had to chase the cat away. But we basically had people lining up to come and watch over the turns to make sure that they could get through the breeding season. And you know, we thought that our efforts had been rewarded. We thought that the fact that the city of Mandurah had sent out the letters and there had been news press, that the person that potentially owned the cat, because we didn't know whether it was a pet cat or a stray cat at that stage. So we thought that the problem had been resolved. And so, unfortunately, the monitoring stopped, the night watches stopped, because we got a security guard, which was very expensive.
So talking about, you know, the security guard and how you guys had put in a big effort to make sure that, you know, cats didn't come through, but they seemed to be just, the one cat just kept coming.
It did. And we actually had reports after, once, you know, this story came out, because, you know, there was a lot of press in the local papers, everybody was outraged. You know, people began coming forward to say that, you know, they had seen this cat for a long period of time. It had been living in an abandoned house. So it looked like it is a stray cat. And but one of the interesting things about the story was that it was a de-sexed cat. So at some point in the cat's life, it's probable that it was owned by somebody. But unfortunately, you know, it's been left. And, you know, we all know now what free-roaming cats are capable of. To destroy a whole colony of threatened seabirds is really devastating. And, you know, people were just really taken aback. And we actually had a local reporter contact us recently to say that they had been down in Mandurah to talk about, you know, what really mattered to the community. This is a year on from what happened. And they weren't specifically interested in fairy turns. They were just wondering what people were interested in the community. And everybody was saying, what happened with the fairy turns? You know, are the fairy turns going to come back? And so I guess it really highlights the potential for, you know, to build a relationship with a particular species and foster good, strong stewardship within the community. And, you know, when I was down there doing my work, people were coming down every single day to have a look through the scope and to see the chicks hatching, to see the different types of behaviour that were going on. You know, they became our birds. People were so proud to have the fairy terns there. So to have this happen was devastating. And for myself, you know, I guess, you know, it was really, really heartbreaking. It's probably been the hardest part of my PhD, not only just to see that happen, but then to relive the experience when I wrote the paper and then it go, I guess, global. You know, it's been a really mixed emotional experience. But I guess for me, one of the hardest things was that we lost 6 breeding adults. So losing chicks, you know, it happens all the time. You could get a single storm event and it could wipe out an entire colony. But to lose breeding adults is significant. We're talking about birds that live for long periods of time. You know, they have low breeding success. So it is devastating to lose those adults. But with all the press that came about and to be able to share the story, to then have the council go and change their legislation by introducing a new CAT Act, I guess it's a silver lining. And the fact that I've been able to use this story and it's being cited by other scientists to highlight the impact of individual cats, I guess, you know, I feel like it wasn't all in vain because, you know, if this didn't happen, you know, it'd be business as usual. And this thing would just be going on behind our back and we don't know it. The only difference is that I was able to be there and to document the decline.
And I guess that's what made the study so interesting as well, was because I guess there was lots of science around, you know, the overall impact of many cats, but there hadn't been this kind of, you know, tangible example of just one cat's damage.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that it is a de-sexed cat. Now, it raises really interesting questions because in other countries, they're proposing that trap neuter release is a way that you can control cats within the community. And, you know, this type of cat, this de-sexed free-roaming cat, is exactly the type of cat that would be out there. And it doesn't consider the impacts on wildlife at all. So these cats go on killing. Just because a cat is provisioned doesn't stop them killing. You know, they're natural born predators.
Because it wasn't eating the birds, was it? It was kind of just killing them and leaving them.
Yeah, so some of the birds definitely were, you know, their breasts were opened and, you know, they definitely had been depredated. But in terms of the small chicks, we don't know exactly that the cat specifically killed all the chicks, but certainly by the adults having to leave their nests for long periods of time during the middle of the night, those chicks would have cooled to a point where they couldn't actually thermoregulate their body temperature. And so, you know, the cat may have been directly responsible for some of those deaths, but also a number of those birds probably would have died because they weren't being attended to by the adults.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
One of the things that came out of the Australian bushfires was, I guess there were all these ecologists doing field work that basically all their data had just gone out the door with the bushfires. I'm wondering, you faced a similar situation with the fairy terns in that a cat kind of just wiped out your data. How does it feel when that happens? Like, you know, both from a work perspective, but from an emotional perspective as well.
It didn't really impact my particular study so much. At that point, I was mainly just monitoring the progress of the colony. But to lose a colony of birds from an introduced predator is really devastating. We did have a number of colonies this year that were appear to have been depredated by both cats and foxes. And it really does have significant impacts on the people that are monitoring those colonies. And I guess one of the problems is that we have very few tools to be able to control cats in urban areas. And one of the problems is that we have, you know, these free-roaming cats that could potentially be cats, but then you also have feral cats and stray cats. So there's a lack of legislative framework to be able to deal with cats, but also there is a lack of, I guess, ownership or, you know, people being doing the right thing by the cats themselves, but also the wildlife.
And now this month you've actually finally published that big study that you had been working on the entire time. What were some of the key revelations that have come out of that?
Just to give the audience a bit of background, we had been catching and banding fairy terns for a number of years. We had been putting little colour bands on the adults, and the chicks, they just get a inkaloi band, which also the adults do get. But the colour bands basically signify the location that the birds were banded. So most of those were colonies, but there were also some night roost locations. And from that information, by going out and recapturing birds, whether that was recapturing them and having them in the hand or using telephotographic lenses to photograph the band number as well as the colour bands, all that information has been used to document the seasonal movements and the metapopulation structure of fairy terns in Western Australia. So I guess the citizen science played a huge role in us being able to answer those questions. So we had a number of people that regularly went out into the field who were interested in documenting fairy terns, and so we used that information basically to see, do the birds come back to the same areas to breed? Are the chicks recruiting once they start breeding into the same colonies that they were hatched? As well as using the colour banding records, how were the birds moving in the landscape? And what we found is that at least 25% of the birds, they were coming back to the same colony to breed between seasons. But then there's also quite a bit of exchange going on between colony sites. But usually that exchange was all going on within a particular area. And so from the movement data that we have, we've been able to determine that there are essentially seven regions where the birds occur, and within a given region there is quite a bit of movement of individuals. So fairy terns and their life cycle, they don't specifically come back to the same breeding site every year. So they nest in quite ephemeral habitats. So those beaches, you know, you think about coastal processes, what goes on during the winter, you know, a whole beach might be wiped out, and so a particular sandbar might not be available from one year to the next. So they do have this tendency to move around in the landscape quite a bit. And so from that information, we've basically been able to see that the birds within a particular area, they do move between the sites, but they tend to stick to a particular area. And as I mentioned, there's seven main areas over which they occur.
And with those areas, and you're saying that they are willing to move, does that suggest that the fairy terns may not return to Mandurah?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. And I'll go into that a bit further. So fairy terns are obviously using these ephemeral habitats. So they're not always available from one year to the next. But Mandurah is a really, really important breeding and feeding site for fairy terns. We had a population of birds that we banded in 2017 down in Bunbury. And so we put the red bands on those birds. Now, in 2018, when I was working down in Mandurah, we saw a lot of birds coming with their red bands. And so we thought, okay, it looks like potentially that Bunbury and Mandurah birds are the same birds, because we're also seeing the red bands. And they were feeding out on the estuary. So they were just feeding there as well as the colony that was actually breeding. And then this season, they did return to Bunbury. And unfortunately, we believe that a cat was responsible for the decline of 180 nests. We've got evidence of cat foot tracks in the area. So that's just another example of the impacts of cats. But after the colony was decimated, we started seeing, for the very first time, birds appearing on Penguin Island. So this is the first year that fairy terns have ever nested on Penguin Island. And so I packed my bag and I moved over to Penguin Island for a few weeks, and I began documenting the colony as well as the diet of fairy terns there. And one of the interesting things to come out of the study was that not only did we have five red-banded birds there, they were all nesting in really close proximity. So three of them were nearest neighbours, which is really interesting because you would think, you know, if this was random, if the birds just happened to be breeding in at the same location, you might expect that they would be dispersed. But the fact that they were random, that they were aggregated, you know, made me question: is there something going on here? And so I've gone back and I've looked at the banding records, and what we see is that we have this. It looks like there's this tendency of birds who have nested together before to re-nest together in subsequent years. And it's been documented in common terns, which are another species that use these ephemeral habitats. They've got some long-running banding studies that show that there's this group adherence in the terns, and over time it becomes stronger. So it looks like birds, they like to nest with their friends, birds that they've nested with in the past, and yeah, it gets stronger with age.
Wow. So basically, so they recognise these birds like each year, and they consciously kind of choose them.
Yeah, it's a strong possibility that this is what is happening. You know, if you think about fairy terns, they're very vocal during the breeding season. They're able to individually recognise calls. If you're on the beach watching a pair of fairy terns, the male will signal his arrival with a fish, and the female will react to the male before he's even arrived at the colony. And it's the same with the chicks. You know, you're in a bustling colony where there's a lot of noise going on, but the birds, they do, and they are able to recognise the individual calls of their parents and also their mates. And so, you know, that must be such a strong cue that those birds pick up on when they're selecting colony sites, that potentially they are selecting areas with their mates.
And after this study, I mean, what, in your opinion, is the best way that we can ensure the conservation of fairy terns?
So in Western Australia, because we now know the movements of the birds, and as part of my other research, I've been looking at the natural history of the species. So, you know, looking at, you know, what do they do during the breeding season? How long does it take for the eggs to hatch? How long does it take for the chicks to be able to fly? What are the colony formation processes? What are the preferences in terms of habitat selection? So all that information that I've been collecting, combined with knowing how the birds are moving in the landscape, we've determined that based on these seven regions, that these should be the management units for being able to conserve fairy terns long into the future. So making sure that within those seven regions that you have a suitable number of sites to be able to cater for the birds that are breeding in those regions. So you're effectively creating habitats that allow for the aggregation of birds every year and for successful nesting. And one of the things that we're trialling here in Western Australia is the use of managed sites. So a managed site is essentially a area that is designated for a specific purpose, so for fairy tern breeding, And then we manage that habitat to suit the needs, the habitat needs of the target species. And obviously those habitats would be, you know, they're set up in historically important breeding areas where there are the fundamental resource requirements of the target species. So by creating managed habitats and trying to deter predators, you know, doing all that trapping and the things that, I guess, limit breeding success, you know, other things such as colony inundation, so having sites that are well above the high tide mark, putting all these things into place to be able to make sure that we can improve nesting outcomes is really what we need to do.
Mm. And more broadly, there have been several reports on the worrying decline in the world's seabirds. And obviously with what you've experienced with very terns and cat predation, I mean, are you worried about extinctions?
I guess, you know, you only have to look at the New Zealand fairy tern to realise how important this issue is. So the New Zealand fairy tern is down to less than 40 birds.
Oh my gosh.
And they've got about 9 breeding pairs. So my work is really, really important. You know, we need to know what are the fundamental requirements of these birds, what is their behaviour, what do we need to do to, you know, to put measures in place to ensure the longevity of the species. And unfortunately, when you get down to 40 birds, no matter how much you study them, their behaviour is fundamentally changed because of the small population size. So, yeah, I really hope that all of the work that I'm doing here in Western Australia can be used to help improve outcomes, not just in New Zealand, but also in the eastern states of Australia where their populations have declined significantly. And then going further afield and, you know, talking about the New Caledonian subspecies, which is down to only, you know, several hundred individuals.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm really interested in doing research for a purpose. And so for me, being able to undertake research to improve outcomes for birds is kind of like a dream come true. And, you know, to think that at the end of my research that I'm going to have a significant body of work that is directly going to be going into the management of a species is already happening. My work is already being used to inform management. You know, I don't have the words to describe it, but it's just, you know, it's really fulfilling.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me about your important work with fairy terns today, Claire. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.